Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Raul Rojas. He's a professor of mathematics and statistics at the University of Nevada, Reno, and professor emeritus of computer science and mathematics at the Free University of Berlin. And we're talking about his book, The Language of Mathematics, The Stories Behind the Symbols. Raul, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book. Now, this is a book that explains the background, the history, the evolution of symbols and operations we take for granted in mathematics. I mean, if I talk to an average person and ask them about the addition sign or the subtraction sign, they have no idea that that stuff had to be created. Raul?
Yes, but what was the question?
It was, you know, most people don't understand that these symbols and operations had to be created in order for us to use them.
Oh, yeah, I see, Mark. So what happens is that when we learn mathematics in school and in high school, usually the teachers, the professors, they don't go into the history of the subject as I think they should.
Oh, yeah.
And the history of the mathematical symbols is something that has only been studied by specialists. So there are books for historians of mathematics, and there are some papers for historians of mathematics detailing how the different symbols came to be. But I think that this information should be given to the students because it makes the subject more interesting. It also, what I always say is that it wakes up the students in the classroom because then they realize that mathematics is not just an abstract subject. It has a history, and a very interesting history.
And it's a really complicated history, too. It what's interesting for me is when I took math in primary school, in grade school, there was no idea that there was a history to mathematics taught. Nobody knew anything about who major mathematicians were from years before. We just learned it as something that we were supposed to do.
Yeah, it happens also with language. So if you look at the history of alphabets,
yeah,
and for writing mathematics or for writing anything, you need an alphabet, you need some kind of writing. It has a very, very long story, beginning with the alphabets developed by the Phoenicians and then the Hebrew alphabet, the Latin alphabet that came later. And mathematics was written first, at the beginning of the subject, just using words, just describing what you need to do on paper in order to solve a problem, but without any kind of notation. And so mathematics has advanced from this old history of rhetorical mathematics, as it is called, to the present level where we have symbols, so that's symbolic mathematics. And in between, we have had every kind of mixture of these words and symbols until we have the mathematics of today. But what many people don't know is the symbols of mathematics have been fixed just for the last 100 years,
yeah,
or less,
yeah,
while mathematics has a history encompassing 22 centuries.
Well, let's start talking about algebra. Where did the word algebra come from?
Well, the word algebra is an Arabic word, and it was the name of a book written by a very well-known mathematician, Al-Khwarizmi. In his book, he explains how to solve simple equations, linear equations, quadratic equations. And the word algebra appears in that book, and it means something like manipulating, solving equations, especially dealing with equations like balance, like a balance with two plates.
Yeah.
And if you do something, if you add weight on one side, you have to add weight on the other side. So that means anything that you do mathematically on one side of the equation, you have to do that on the other side. And so from this book, where the word algebra was in the title, it became known in Europe as the art of solving equations. It was also called the Cossic art, the art of things. the art of dealing with things, mathematical things in this case, and algebra was also the name used for dealing with this subject.
Now, the translation of his book is the compendium book on calculation by completion and balancing. And you described it as a recipe book. What does that mean?
Well, that means that today if you learn to solve equations in high school, then they tell you there is the quadratic equation, and they give you a formula for solving the quadratic equation. So you just have to substitute in that formula the numbers that you have in your specific equation. In the case of that book from Al-Khwarizmi, they will tell you, for example, if you want to divide the number 35 into two pieces plus a third piece, which is twice the size of the first two pieces, then you need to multiply the number by three, and then you have to divide that number by five, or do whatever manipulation you need to do. And they would be explained for a simple example, for a single example, not for the general case where you use symbols and you say, we have unknowns, X, Y, and Z, and then we solve for the unknowns. In this case, they give you a concrete example. The book tries to give you many, many different examples dealing with many different cases of the linear or the quadratic equation. And then when you have your own equation, which has different numbers in it, then you have to go to this handbook. It's like a handbook. Look which is the closest problem that looks like my problem, and then follow the same steps as they were given to you in the book. So there is no general formula. There is just a collection of examples.
Who is the audience for this book? Is it mostly merchants and people who were in the, you know, had to trade goods? Is that who would buy a book like this?
Yes, the audience for these kind of books for example, in the 1500s in Italy, and also in the Arabic time when the Arabs were in Spain, the audience were not really the merchants. The audience was a specialized group of people who could do accounting or could work with numbers. They were called, in Germany, they were called Rechenmeister. That means the master of numbers. And merchants would have as employees these people who could deal with numbers. And those were the people who could buy the books. We must remember that there was no printing press at the time that these books were being developed or written in the Arabic countries. And so these books had to be copied by hand. Wow. And copying a book by hand was just very expensive. And that means that only people who really needed to knew this kind of manipulations, they were the only ones who were able to buy the books. So the Rechenmeister or the merchants, they were those people buying the books, which were very expensive. And the general population was illiterate and was not used to dealing with numbers, just with the small numbers that were needed for buying something or for getting change in a market operation. But most of the population in Europe and in other countries was illiterate and also non-numerical, so to say.
I want to go back to the ancient Greeks for a minute. Now, they didn't have algebra, did they?
No, they solved problems using geometry. That's also one interesting thing.
When I read that in your book, I thought that was very bizarre. They were essentially doing algebraic problems, but using geometry?
Yes, exactly.
That sounds really strange to me.
Yeah, that is strange, but that's something that you learn if you study mathematics. If you go to college, then there's usually a geometry class and a class about proofs, proving mathematical theorems. And then the first kind of proofs that you find are those written by the Greeks. And the Greeks had a very, very interesting way of solving numerical problems. They would pick a geometrical figure, where the sides of the figure, for example, a square, you could have the sides of a square being of length 1, and then they could show that the side of the diagonal or the length of the diagonal was the square root of 2. And so if you wanted to find the square root of a number, then you would draw a square, then you would measure the diagonal, and that could be then the square root you were following. And they had methods for multiplying segments, the lengths of segments,
wow,
for dividing the lengths of segments, for adding segments. And so when anybody had a numerical problem, they would go to the blackboard, so to say, draw a geometrical figure and solve for that geometrical figure. That was the way of geometricizing algebraic problems, as we say today.
They couldn't solve something like a quadratic equation, though, using geometry, could they?
For special cases, it's possible. And in fact, the book by Al-Khwarizmi, they show how to solve a quadratic equation using the surface of squares.
Yeah.
And cuts in the squares. That's why we say that for solving a quadratic equation, we complete the square.
Huh.
We complete the geometrical figures. And then from that completion, we get the answer to the problem. And that's the Greek approach to solving numerical problems.
You have photographs in the book, The Language of Mathematics, of many ancient texts. Did you get to see these texts, or is that just taken from online?
Something very interesting has happened in the last years. I have been working on this book for many years, so almost 30 years, because I use the results from my own classes at the university. And at the beginning, when we were doing this, I had seminars with students, and they had to go to the library to investigate the origin of mathematical symbols, and then try to get all copies of mathematical books. But now many of these books have been digitized. So we have Arabic books, which have been digitized. We have also medieval books about mathematics. We have the books written in the Renaissance. And then it's now much easier. You can go to the sources directly from your computer, and you can compare. It's very, very difficult sometimes because the language is not your language. It's Arabic, or maybe it's Latin, which is also not easy to read. But you can figure out from the pictures, you can figure out from the layout of the page which kind of symbols were being used. And they stand out because at the time most of the mathematics being done was done using just verbal descriptions. And so the few symbols that they were there, they stand out on the page.
What's the most frequently used mathematical symbol?
Well, today the most frequently used mathematical symbol is the equality symbol, because every time you write about mathematics, you have equations, and then you have a left side and you have a right side, and then you develop and you continue having the left and the right side. And so equality symbol is the most used symbol, other than the numbers themselves. So I'm not talking about, for example, the digits. So, of course, the digits also are very frequent in mathematical texts. But the equality symbol happens to be the most used symbol because it appears in almost every equation. And then we have the grouping symbols, like parentheses,
yeah,
so brackets for grouping operations. This is a very late development in the history of notation, also in the history of language, because the first brackets in history, the first parentheses, were introduced around the 1500s in books for dealing with novels or dealing with descriptions of things, and then they were also used in mathematics. So every time also the written language changes, mathematics has changed adopting some of their symbols.
How much did the invention of the printing press change notation in mathematics?
Yeah, that's a very important development in the history of mathematics, because first the books had to be copied, and they were copied in monasteries, or they were copied by special scribes that were hired by merchants or other people. When the printing press came around, then there was an explosion of books, of course, and there was an explosion also of books about mathematics. And, for example, many people started, of course, reading. They needed to know the letters of the alphabet. But also many other people started getting acquainted with mathematics, getting the special knowledge that was necessary to deal with numbers. And so instead of having the special shocks where the books were being copied by hand, like they had in Italy, now suddenly you could print 1,000 copies or 2,000 copies of a book. And then when you had the printing press, people had to agree on a common notation because it was impossible to use the different notations in every book. And so different national traditions developed, especially in the Germanic countries, also in the English-speaking countries and the French-speaking countries and in Italy. Those were the four principal mathematical regions at the time. And every book tried to start having a common notation in these four regions. Then it took time for those regions to come together. But the printing press produced a revolution in the diffusion of mathematical symbols.
You write a lot in the book about how different notations for the same operation, like, say, multiplication, different ones would come out at different times, and sometimes they would disappear, certain notations, and then come back again later, years later. But it really took somebody to sort of publicize and make famous or make common certain symbols for them to be adopted.
Yes. For example, when the digits, the Arabic, Hindu-Arabic digits were introduced in Europe by Fibonacci and other writers, that was in the 12th century, the books helped to diffuse that notation, that new notation. And later on, when the printing press came around, then writers of mathematics like Johannes Wittmann in Leipzig in Germany, he proposed the symbols for the plus and minus that we use today, while the Italians were using the P and M from più and meno, so the first letter of the word più and the first letter of the word meno for plus and minus. And so the fact that the book of Johannes Wittmann was printed in many editions, in many thousands of copies for the people who wanted to learn to work with numbers, and also the books of the Italians were printed in many thousands of copies, meant that these two different kinds of writing mathematics went around with diffuse, were known for by more people. And so the printing press had a very good part in that diffusion process. And then what helped to stabilize the notation was the work of famous mathematicians. So famous mathematicians who were read by their peers in many countries, they helped to fixate the notation, like was the case of Descartes, the French Descartes, who fixated the notation for the algebra that we have today.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Raul Rojas. He's a professor of mathematics and statistics at the University of Nevada, Reno, and professor emeritus of computer science and mathematics at the Free University of Berlin. And we're talking about his new book. I find it really fascinating. The Language of Mathematics, The Stories Behind the Symbols. Now, I got to ask you something. At one part in your book, you start talking about what the most beautiful mathematical formulas are.
Yeah, that's something that sounds strange.
Well, I actually, many years ago, I interviewed a mathematician who, he wrote a book, and it was called Because It's Beautiful. And it was a whole, each chapter was a different formula. And he writes about, and he was a mathematician, about why that's beautiful. Now, when you say beautiful, can you, as a mathematician, why is one formula more beautiful than another?
Yes. So I was once in a talk given by a historian who was talking about the biography of a famous mathematician. And then she said, they say that mathematics can be elegant, and she also said, I don't know what the mathematicians mean by that. And what we mean when we talk about elegance in mathematics is that a single formula, which is very easy to write, or that has just a few symbols, can synthesize and can tell you a lot about geometry or a lot about algebra. So, for example, the famous Pythagorean equation x squared plus y squared equals c squared applied to a triangle, where you say that the sum of the squares of the triangle equals the square of the hypotenuse. That's a beautiful formula because it can be used for many different, for solving many different problems. It's also the basis of all the trigonometry. So trigonometry means measuring triangles. And every time you have to deal with triangles or you have to deal with polygons that can be decomposed into triangles, then you happen to need that formula, that Pythagorean formula. And so the formula is not difficult to learn. It's easy to the eye, so you could recognize the formula every time you see it. And then in that case, we say, because the formula encompasses so much of mathematics, and we say that formula is elegant.
Okay, I totally accept Pythagorean theorem as being beautiful. But you list two others, Euler's identity and Euler's theory, which is V minus E plus F equals 2. To me, I'm not a mathematician, obviously, but to me, those seem more complex and less knowable than A squared plus B squared equals C squared. I mean, the thing about the Pythagorean theorem is it was actually uncovered in several different cultures almost at the same time. But the Euler's theory, the Euler's identity, it uses imaginary and complex numbers. That seems, why do you think that's your personal opinion? Why do you think that's beautiful?
Well, that's not just my personal opinion. There was a survey several years ago that was sent to mathematicians asking them which ones are the most beautiful mathematical formulas.
Yeah.
And then Pythagoras and the formula by Euler's identity, they came on top.
Really?
And in the case, yes, they came on top in that survey. And that's because in the case of Euler's identity, you have many symbols which are very important today. You have the letter E, which is the so-called Euler constant. It's used for computing logarithms and for computing exponentials.
Mm-hmm.
You also have the letter pi, the Greek letter pi, which gives you the relationship between the diameter of a circle and its perimeter. So it's another very important, let's say, natural constant. You also have the imaginary unit I in the exponent, and you have then the one which is the basis for building all other numbers. So you see, in one single formula, which is very easy to write, you have E, you have pi, you have I, and you have one.
You also have zero. You also have zero.
And you also have zero. So you have some kind of formula where you have natural constants integrated, and when you have something like this, very easy to write, then you say that's a powerful formula, but it's also elegant.
It's almost like it's a little history of mathematics in one formula.
Yes, because you can develop, for example, trigonometry just from the Euclidean formula, so you can develop everything. But you can also start from the Euler formula, and then you can develop the concept of the cosine and sine of an angle and the relationship between sine and cosine and so on. So you can start from the Euclidean, from the Euler formula, and then you can do all of trigonometry.
It's fascinating to read about you write a lot about important books in mathematics over the last centuries, and one of them is a person from Venice, Leonardo of Pisa, also known as Fibonacci.
Yes.
And you wrote that he wrote one of the most influential books in the history of mathematics.
Yes, it's that book was very, very influential because Fibonacci, as he was called, he traveled in the Mediterranean. He went to the Arabic countries. He went to the Middle East. And then he learned the mathematics, the old mathematics of the Greeks, and also the new mathematics of the Arabs that they were that was developed at the time. And then he came back to Europe, to Italy, and he introduced the Hindu Arabic notations. He introduced the digits that we use today for the merchants and Regenmeister that I was mentioning. At the time, if you wanted to compute something, the abacus was used. So
right.
The Regenmeister would take his abacus and would compute on the abacus. But what Fibonacci could show is that by following the recipes of the Arabs and the methods of the Arabs, you could write and solve problems on paper. So using pen and paper. And also that it could be even faster than using the abacus, especially when you were doing multiplication and division. And so this book really changed the course of history because the methods that were being used in Arabic countries were exported to Europe. So mathematics came from Europe, from the Greeks, to the Arabic countries, and then came back to Europe through the work of these Arabic mathematicians.
We're all out of time, and I have pages more of questions to ask you. My guest tonight is Raul Rojas. He's a professor of mathematics and statistics at the University of Nevada, Reno, and professor emeritus of computer science and mathematics at the Free University of Berlin. And we've been talking about his book. It's really a fascinating read. You get to learn about the history of zero, about the history of the minus sign, the language of mathematics, the stories behind the symbols. Raul, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much, Mike. I hope that new readers will find the book interesting.
It's fascinating.
As I was saying, people tend to get distracted by the abstraction that we have in mathematics. But once we understand that mathematics has a history and that these symbols have a very interesting origin, then maybe the subject could be less abstract. For many.
I hope so. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Good night.